You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Hi, everybody. My name is David McKeegan. I am the co-founder of GreenbackTaxServices.com. We focus on helping Americans who live outside the United States to get and stay compliant on their U.S. taxes. And today we're going to have a little bit of a chat about a couple that's looking to move abroad and has some pretty interesting questions and an interesting perspective. So with that, would you guys like to say hi?
Hey, everyone. I'm Megan, and my husband, Matt. We are dual military. I live in the U.S. Matt lives abroad in the U.K.
Yeah, and we're both serving our respective navies. I'm in the Royal Navy, Megan's in the U.S. Navy, and we're currently in the United States at the moment recording this. We have one house that we rent, one house that we own, and we're on our path to buy, I guess. We started only at the start of this year, so we haven't been on it for long. We haven't known about it for long, but here we are.
Yeah, as the guys always say on the Choose FI podcast, the sooner you start, the sooner you're going to get there. So the best time to start is 10 years ago. The second best time is today. So first off, congratulations on being on the path. You know, why don't we jump in a little bit and we can have a conversation about what you guys are looking to do and what the potential pitfalls are given your specific situation, meaning that one of you is a U.S. citizen. U.S. citizens are taxed globally by the IRS. One of you is a UK citizen. Fortunately, UK citizens are not taxed globally by their government. And you know, we can see what it is you want to do and how to try and set yourselves up so that you can get there financially.
Yeah. So where we are at the moment, our current plan, if all goes well, is for me to move to the United States on a green card. We're married. We've been married for just over a year now. And then Megan will continue in her job with the US Navy in order to get her military pension. And then I'll come over here, hopefully with the right to work and help on the side with our goal to FI. Once we're at the end of Megan's career, when you're eligible, then we're looking to do that leap abroad as well.
Cool. And how long do you have until you're eligible for the military pension?
5 more years.
5 more years. Okay. So that's... without a pension, 5 years would be doable but aggressive. But I guess with a military pension, that's probably a lot more workable.
Yeah, we're looking at more at like 7 before I'd actually retire, but 5 will put me at 20 years.
Okay, awesome. You know, one of the things you just mentioned is going to play a very important role in how you do things. So, Matt, you just mentioned that you're looking to get your green card. And once you get your green card, you will be taxed just like every other U.S. citizen. And, you know, that's going to have a big impact on, you know, potential investments that you hold in the U.K. or, you know, in other countries around the world. I know one of the things you mentioned in the notes you sent over to me was that you're looking to sell an apartment, correct?
Yeah, so I own an apartment in the southwest in Bath in the U.K. I've done some of my own sums and decided that it's not worth the sweat, pay the hassle of maintaining a property in a different country. And I would rather just sell it, have that money to be able to put towards our future in our investments in the United States. So yeah, it's quite a large one at the moment because I don't know where I stand. If I get the green card before I sell it, or if we start the visa process before I sell it, and in that tax year, for the purposes of the IRS, create almost $200,000 out of nowhere in equity.
Right. That's not a problem. The problem isn't that you would enter the U.S. with a bunch of assets. Before you get taxed as a U.S. person, the assets you bring to the table aren't taxed. There's no wealth tax in the U.S. However, if you get your green card and sell the property after, or if you meet the substantial presence test, meaning that you're in the U.S. basically too much, and so you're considered a tax resident of the U.S., you would owe capital gains tax on that flat in the U.S., or could potentially owe tax on that. I'm sure you know Boris Johnson. Boris got hit a couple years ago, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, when he sold his flat in Islington, because he was born in the U.S., so he had an American passport. He was a U.S. citizen, even though he was, you know, he's now the prime minister of the U.K. And so he got hit with a big tax bill from the IRS for selling that flat. Because for people listening, if you're in the U.K. and you sell your primary residence, it's capital gains free, where that's not the case in the U.S. Do you have any idea how much of a gain you would have on that property? Is it a big gain or?
So it'd be about £60,000. So $80,000 in gain profit.
Yeah, you might want to try and get that sold before becoming a U.S. person, as it were, before you get the green card. And then the other thing you need to know is that, do you have a mortgage on the property?
I do, yeah.
You might have an issue with the mortgage. Let me just find my notes here, because the pound has dropped against the dollar, so there might be a gain or a loss on the dollar amount of that loan. Let's see. So there's another form that you would need to be filling out in order to explain to the IRS what's going on with that mortgage. Sorry, I've got a whole big long page of notes here. So it'd be, the form is the Section 988 tax on mortgage redemption. So you could fall under a capital gain tax, and you could also fall under this mortgage redemption tax if the value has changed significantly from when you took it out. So that's one thing that you want to think about and potentially avoid by selling earlier. The other thing that a lot of people can fall foul of, this is an area that you don't hear a lot about when you're in the United States, because it doesn't really impact you if you're in the United States. Megan, you've seen 1099s. You know, they report your interest, your capital gains, the sale of all of your shares or dividends and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government instituted a law that's called FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. And basically, this says that every single bank around the world needs to send the information on U.S. citizens to the Treasury Department. Otherwise, they face all kinds of withholding taxes in the U.S. on any assets they have in the U.S. So pretty much every bank around the world is now reporting 1099-style information to the United States. So if you have assets overseas, let's say you sell your flat and you have a gain of £60,000, you put that into a Hargreaves Lansdown, you know, investment account in the U.K., and then you become a U.S. citizen. Or not a U.S. citizen, a U.S. green card holder. Now you're going to have to pay tax and capital gains on those funds, and you're also going to have to report that account to the IRS each year. So you're going to have to fill out the FinCEN 114, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Center Form 114. Sounds very scary. It's a relatively easy form to fill out. I actually just filled out ours the other day. Annoyingly, we have a number of accounts that are open in the UK from when we lived in the UK that only have 1p in the account, but I have to get myself back there and go to the branch in order to close out the account. So every year I have to go in and report these accounts to the Treasury Department. The other thing that you have to know about is mutual funds outside of the United States aren't necessarily viewed as mutual funds inside the United States. And this can apply even to Vanguard funds, Fidelity funds. You know, the UK and Ireland are big centers for mutual funds, and so they set a lot of these up. The US government oftentimes will view these as passive foreign investment companies. And so instead of having your capital gains, you know, roll every year and you don't get taxed on that until you sell the mutual fund, or, you know, some of the benefits of mutual funds in the United States, you're going to have to pay tax on those each year. Now, there is a way around this, and I'm going to send a link to you guys right now. Vanguard has a number of different funds. Vanguard, you guys probably know, is very popular in the FI community, but they're U.S. domiciled ETFs that are HMRC reporting funds. So that basically just means that these funds are exempt from the PFIC requirements because they're meeting the correct reporting requirements for both the U.S. and the U.K. So that's something to think about. If you have any ISAs, any SIPs, anything like that, you might want to look at consolidating those into funds that are appropriate funds. And ISAs fall foul of the IRS trust requirement. They're viewed as trusts, not retirement vehicles, whereas SIPs are okay. So if you have SIPs in the UK, those are okay. Just make sure you have decent funds in them. The ISAs you might want to consider because they could trigger trust reporting for those funds.
The only thing I have personally is a cash ISA. There's no other mutual funds at the moment. The only ETFs and mutual funds we hold are in the United States and they're Vanguard. We don't have hold any in the UK. The only investments are real estate with the apartment and then a little bit of cash as well.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So just be aware that you don't want to fall foul of these PFIC rules. To the extent that you're investing overseas, make sure that they're U.S. compliant funds as well.
We've actually written several articles about great value cell phone companies with fantastic service. And here's why I think Mint Mobile checks all the boxes for the FI community. First and foremost, great value, $15 a month for 3 gigabytes of data. Number two, arguably the most important here, you get to keep your existing phone and number. Mint Mobile makes it really easy to switch, but the fact that you can bring your phone with you is absolutely key. Unlimited talk and text on a premium network without the premium fees. Now, having said all that, I personally still would not have switched if it were too complicated. And I can confirm that when I switched, it was a breeze. 5-minute phone call, move your SIM over, you're done. It just works. Free shipping when you use our link, mintmobile.com/choosefi. If you're still using one of the big wireless providers this year, have you asked yourself what you're really paying for? Between the big expensive box store, the inflated prices, the hidden fees, you're getting taken advantage of because they know you'll pay for it. Get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the startup kit shipped to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/choosefi. That's mintmobile.com/choosefi. One word. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/choosefi. Hey everyone, back by popular demand. We're going to be offering our entrepreneurship summer camp this fall as our fall challenge to young business owners. And Brad, I know we've actually talked about in the show, but this has had a massive impact on your family.
Yeah, Jonathan, you're absolutely right. My kids went through the Simple Startup Workbook and it made them think like entrepreneurs. And it was just so refreshing to see the questions that they came back to me with while they were going through the book. And that has extended for months now to the point where my older daughter, Anna, and her friends are now potentially starting up an animal grooming business, which is really, it's just so exciting to see them get together and talk through. They've spent hours on the phone just talking through all the ins and outs. And the genesis was this book.
Yeah, this has proven to be a fun and very successful program for entrepreneurs. And I'll just say this, we've said it before, but it's so true. It's more true now than ever. Not everyone needs to be an entrepreneur, but everyone, especially your kids going into the future, they need to think like one. This Simple Startup will do that. So the course, it's going to be a virtual course. It's going to run from October 5th to December 11th. It's an $80 entry fee, which does also include a copy of the workbook. Registration is open now, but that's going to close on August 31st or if it sells out sooner. So if you're at all interested, make sure you register. We did two of these over the summer and they sold out incredibly quickly, but we want to make sure everyone is actually getting their course materials on time. You're going to get actionable life skills in creating, marketing, and running a business for your student. For more information, go to choosefi.com/fall challenge. That's one word, choosefi.com/fall challenge for more information.
Now, that's most of the scary stuff. All these random forms that you've probably never heard of that you can fall foul of without knowing they ever existed. I think what you guys want to hear a bit more about is how you can take advantage of the U.S. tax system and your setup as a U.S. and a non-U.S. person.
Yeah.
So that you can get to FI faster, or when you're overseas, you've retired from the military, you don't get hit with big U.S. tax bills every year.
Exactly. So, and just to simplify the tax as well once we're away.
Right. Now, what you'd probably want to do is once you're ready to leave the United States, you're going to want to give up your green card. Because if you don't give up your green card, you're going to continue to be taxed as a U.S. person.
Yep.
And you actually have to physically give it up. You have to turn it in. There's paperwork you have to complete. So don't just say, I'm leaving. Thanks anyway, guys. I'm not going to renew or whatever it is. You actually have to physically go in and say, I'm giving this up and hand it back. What that will then do is mean that you are not being taxed in the U.S. anymore. So you can start taking advantage of some of the international investments. A company like Interactive Brokers might be a good one to look at, where you can set up an account with them. You can invest in very similar, broad market ETFs. You can invest in these Vanguard ETFs that are broad market, but it's offshore for the UK and it's outside of the US. And you as a non-US person would then not be taxed on that by the US, and you would not be taxed on that by the UK.
Sorry, what about the transfer? Because before that point, I will have been living for 5 to 7 years or possibly a little bit more in the United States. That moment that it ceases, all of our investments would still have been in the USA. So what are you talking about, a transfer of that holding pot over to myself, but Interactive Brokers or the international investment side?
Right. You want to make sure that you're not triggering an exit tax. So if your net worth is over $2 million at the time you're looking to leave, you could trigger an exit tax. So you want to make sure that you do it before you trigger that.
Right.
In addition, you can set up an account with someone like Interactive Brokers before then. You would just have the additional reporting requirements for having the account be outside the United States. So, again, just make sure if you do that, that you're setting it up in the right way and that you're investing in funds that are safe for you to invest in.
And that would all have to just be under Matthew's name. We wouldn't be able to go joint on that, right, because of my U.S. citizenship?
Correct. Yeah, I had a call a couple of years ago with this couple in Australia, and the husband was Australian, the wife was a U.S. citizen, and they were asking, hey, should we be filing jointly, all this. And the husband turns to the wife and says, if you try and put me on your U.S. tax return, I am divorcing you. I'll still live with you. We can still live in the same house. I am not getting wrapped up in all this U.S. tax nonsense.
And that's been our biggest thing this past year when I had to file my taxes. It was very confusing for me because I was like, should we go jointly? Should I go separately? I didn't want to force Matthew in bed with the IRS if he didn't have to be.
Right. So if you're moving to the U.S., if you're getting a green card, then you guys are in the same boat. Pardon the pun. But when you then go abroad, you probably won't want to retain the U.S. tax status. There are exceptions to that. So if you don't really have any income and you don't have any assets outside the U.S. at that point, you might want to retain your U.S. tax status and continue to file married filing jointly because you have a higher exemption. Are you guys considering kids at some point?
Eventually, yeah.
So if, let's say, 7 years from now, you've got a little one running around and you decide to leave the United States, Megan, you would then be able to file as head of household. So you wouldn't be filing married separate. You'd be filing as head of household, and you'd be reporting yourself and your dependent that way.
Right.
So you get some of the advantages in that case without a lot of the hassle that would go from having Matt in the same bucket there.
Yeah. So in that kind of branching period that we have, you mentioned it a little bit there, and Meg kind of said about jumping into bed with the IRS. We did speak a lot about potentially with the taxes that we've just done and maybe the next taxes about including me, since I'm going to be here anyway at some point, to have that added tax history, which I've heard that the border guys really like here to let you in the country or whatever, but also for the extra exemptions and whatnot. But would that play into their hands more and kind of take the control away from us? Would it be beneficial to do that? Or because I want to sell the property in that period, I'm kind of wondering if married filing jointly is something that we should hold off on again until I'm established here.
Well, I think probably what you'd want to do is sell the property before you start filing married filing jointly.
Right, okay.
You would need to look at, and I'll pull this up for you right now, the rules around the substantial presence test. And I'll put this in the chat for you as well. This is just so you guys can have a look at this after we're done with the call. So I'll just read this to you. This is from the IRS website. You'll be considered a U.S. resident for tax purposes if you meet the substantial presence test for the calendar year. To meet this test, you must be physically present in the United States on at least 31 days during the current year and 183 days during the three-year period that includes the current year and the 2 years immediately before, counting all days you were present in the current year, a third of the days that you were present in the year before, and a sixth of the days that you were present in the year before that. So what you'd need to do is, let's say for 2020, you would need to look at how many days you're in the U.S., okay? Then you'd need to look at 2019 and 2018 and count up how many days you're in the U.S. then. And then you've got to see if that's coming close to that 183-day mark. If it is, then technically you're going to be taxed in the U.S., or you should be taxed in the U.S. anyway. So there's no big advantage to waiting or rushing to sell the property. Now, what you can claim is that, you know, your ties are to the U.K., so you should be paying tax in the U.K. first, and then you would have a foreign tax credit that you could use on your U.S. taxes. But if you don't have a capital gains tax on the property, then it's just going to be a gain that you get hit with in the United States. But you're paying tax in the UK now because you're there, right?
Exactly. So it comes automatically out of my paycheck every month. The way it works for us is we don't do a self-assessment at the end of the year either. It's just completely done automatically.
Right. It's a delightfully easy system. I remember that. It took about 2 hours every year to file my taxes in the UK. So you might be building up some tax credits that you'd be able to use on your US tax return. And you'd need to like balance that out. You'd need to dig into that a little bit and see. First, I would look to see if you're going to fall foul of the substantial presence test. And if you fall foul of that, then I would start looking to see if there's any way to count tax credits from the UK to try and offset some of the tax you would owe on the property if you sell the property.
Yeah.
Now, all that said, obviously not everything is around taxes. And I have heard in the past that in getting a green card, it is helpful to do married filing jointly and to report that to the IRS. I've anecdotally heard that that helps with getting a green card, but I'm not a immigration person. I don't know that much about that.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't an episode of 90 Day Fiancé, don't worry. This is long haul. And the decision to come over here has been one that we've been wrestling with. Meg absolutely loves the UK. I mean, you've moved there yourself and lived there for some time. There are pros and cons to both of them. As much as our tax system, for example, is very simple, I do at the end of the day pay a lot more than you do percentage-wise. So one of the other things we wanted to talk about in me moving over here was my separation from the United Kingdom and the armed forces might actually be out of my hands. I might have a tax-free pension for a potential disability. So I wanted to know how the US IRS views overseas tax-free pensions, which I know is probably a really niche thing that doesn't really happen that often.
Right. I took some notes on that as well. Let me dig in here. Okay, so with a tax-free pension, if you're not a green card holder or a U.S. citizen, then it would only be taxable in the U.K. So if it's not taxable in the U.K., you wouldn't have to worry about it in the U.S. However, if you are a green card holder, then it would become taxable in the United States. So even though it's tax-free in the U.K., it would then become taxable in the U.S. as long as you're a green card holder. So if you guys are in the U.S. for 7 years, waiting for Meg to get her pension from the military and following the FI path, for that period, you would be paying U.S. tax on that. But then in the end, when you guys decide to go overseas and live somewhere else, then you would no longer be paying U.S. tax on that because you would turn your green card in before you exit.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's funny, you keep saying about handing the green card back in. And again, anecdotally, and I know you're not a visa expert, but I've heard that once you've handed it in, it's a one-time thing. You don't get it back again.
I don't know about that. Yeah, you know, technically a green card is just a resident work visa, and you're not supposed to leave the country with it. A lot of people do, potentially because of what you just said, because, you know, it might be more difficult to get it a second time. But I don't know the details of how hard or easy that is.
Another one that we wanted to talk to is, you say that you're in Costa Rica, and we're curious, with you having moved around the world into different locations so much, how do you manage your taxes from being there? As in, are you paying, without putting yourself into much trouble, obviously, but how are you paying your taxes in Costa Rica? Because that's going to set the kind of road for how we're going to possibly pay our taxes abroad as well. Presumably, sure. You're very efficient.
We try. So there's a handful of countries around the world that don't tax you on your worldwide income. They only tax you on the income you make from sources within that country. So Costa Rica is one of those countries. Now, our business is set up in the United States, so we're paying U.S. taxes, but we're not paying income taxes in Costa Rica because we're not earning the money here. The money's being earned in the United States. So if you guys had two pensions, one from the U.K. and one from the U.S., potentially you wouldn't have to pay any local tax here in Costa Rica, other than, you know, you're paying VAT taxes and airport taxes and property taxes and all the other taxes that you have, but potentially you wouldn't have any income tax when you were here. And you know, there's a handful of countries around the world that have that. I know Panama has that, Hong Kong, if they don't get absorbed into China, you know, they have rules around, you know, you don't get taxed on income that's outside of Hong Kong. A lot of the Caribbean islands and things like that have separate rules around that as well. And you know, the other thing to think about is a lot of rules around taxation are based on how much time you spend in a specific country. So if you guys have, you know, the travel bug, if you like to be moving around, potentially what you could be doing is looking at how many days you have to be in some of these countries before you become taxable in that country. And then you can stay under that amount of time and just split your time between different places. So, you know, if you want to be in the United States for a month in the summer, you want to be in the UK for a month over the holidays, then you've got 5 months to travel in one part of the world and 5 months to travel in another part of the world. A lot of countries say that you have to be inside their borders for over 183 days before you become taxable in that country. Right. So if you're doing 5 months, you know, called 150 days, two different countries, and then a month in the UK and a month in the US, potentially you would only have a US filing requirement. And that's just because Meg's the US citizen.
Mm-hmm.
All right, trivia for you. Do you know what other countries tax their citizens while living abroad?
I do, personally, because I've had to look at it. Burundi, apparently, is the other country. Is that right?
It's Eritrea.
Oh, Eritrea.
And North Korea. So it tells you what kind of company we're in.
It's a great way of doing it. It's a great way of still earning money while everyone's going away. The other thing as well, and I don't know, because your business is in the United States, if you've ever thought of it, I've seen a lot of people who have spoken about the advantages of giving up US citizenship once they've decided that they're going to live outside the USA. Have you thought about that, first of all, and do the pros outweigh the cons?
I have thought about it. So from a personal perspective, you know, both my parents are still alive. I'm one of six kids. So I've got five brothers and sisters who are living in the U.S. And one of the things that the government has kicked around before is the idea that if you give up your citizenship, they may not let you back in the country. So for me, the risk of that far outweighs the benefits of giving it up and not paying U.S. taxes. And yeah, everybody has to kind of look at that separately in themselves and see whether or not that would make sense for them. But for me and for my wife, it doesn't make a lot of sense because we do have ties to the U.S. and we want to be able to go back there unrestricted and things like that. If you know how to work the rules, like let's say you guys, over the course of the next couple of years, you decide to start a business and it's a business that you can take outside the U.S., okay? So for argument's sake, let's say you incorporate in Wyoming, because Wyoming is a really easy place to incorporate. There's no state income tax, so it's good from that perspective as well. And then you decide that your lifestyle consulting business, you know, you're making $100,000 a year and you can make it on the road, so you can live anywhere in the world you want to live. Let's say that's the situation you guys find yourself in 7 years, right? So you've got $100,000 of income. You can split it between the two of you. And if you maintain your green card, then you guys can set yourself up with 401ks through your business. And you can put away about $20,000 each plus a company match for your 401ks. So for ease of math, let's call that $45,000 between the two of you and your company match. The $55,000 that's left over, you would be paying self-employment tax on. You would be paying both the employee and the employer portion. Currently, that's 15.3%. So you're going to pay, what's that, about $7,000 in self-employment tax. The rest of that income, as long as you are either living permanently in a foreign country or you're physically present inside foreign countries for 330 days in a 365-day period, you can use what's called the foreign earned income exclusion to exclude a bit over $100,000 of U.S. income from taxation. So you've got $45,000 goes into your 401k. You've got $55,000 left over. You pay $7,000 in tax, and the other $48,000 of that is tax-free. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that you hear of a lot of people setting up businesses and going overseas. Now, if you take that example to the most extreme, let's say you have a very profitable business, married filing jointly, you can earn about $285,000 a year, basically only paying about $15,000, $16,000 in self-employment tax. And that's funding your future Social Security benefits. You know, you're getting credit for that while you do that. So there's the flip side of renouncing is if you set yourself up in the right way and you have income sources that can be U.S.-based, you can make a nice salary from that while you're overseas. Now, if you give up your green card, and this is where things start getting more and more interesting. If you give up your green card and you set up the same digital or online business somewhere else, let's say you set it up in, you know, I don't know, Panama or Belize or, you know, one of these countries, and you own that business, you don't get the 401k benefit because it's not a U.S. business. But you would be able to pay yourself as much as you wanted because you're not a U.S. citizen anymore. And you could pay Meg up to that foreign earned income exclusion amount. And because it's not a U.S. business, you wouldn't have the self-employment tax. So you'd be avoiding the self-employment tax on that one.
That's awesome. We're writing that one down.
So I don't know if you've heard of The Simple Startup, the book.
Yeah.
I know the guys did an interview with the author. Get a copy of the book and start having a look at it, because if you're going to be retiring from the military, you're going to be in the U.S., you're looking for something to do, potentially starting your own business, starting your own company could be a really good way of setting yourselves up for the future. A couple of friends of mine run a podcast called The Tropical MBA, and they talk a lot about getting a job that's going to help you learn how to start your own business. You know, working for a startup, working for an entrepreneur, so you get to see what it's all about, how it works, and then you can make that leap at some point yourself. It's something to think about if that's the kind of lifestyle you want to have.
No, absolutely. When Meg leaves, we hope to be in a position to be FIRE anyway, just with that military pension plus any of the investments that we've already made. So I guess past that point, it's whatever we want to do.
Yeah, but I've already been pitching to Matt that he needs to be listening to The Rebel Entrepreneur and coming up with a side hustle for us.
Awesome. So we've got three boys, and the two youngest ones are 7 and 5, and they're taking horseback riding lessons here in Costa Rica. And so they started a business making horse bug spray that they sell at the stable. And yeah, for a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, they're making like $15 a week. They feel like the richest kids in the world.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
And then our 10-year-old is he's homeschooled here, And I've been running a simple startup program for the 8 kids in his homeschool group. And so he's starting a board game called Nosarapoli, which is the town we live in Costa Rica is called Nosara. And so it's basically a Monopoly game for our town. And so he's been working on that for the last couple, last 3 weeks or so, coming up with the different properties, coming up with all the different cards and everything. So it's a lot of fun. Like, I'm a huge fan of entrepreneurship for the freedom and the income and everything like that. But it's also a way to a place or a way to use your creativity in a way that can help other people, which is a benefit as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm assuming your children, the rest of your family are all fluent or very good Spanish speakers from your history and doing your MBA in Barcelona.
We're getting there. So my wife actually grew up in Mexico City, so she's pretty much fluent. I was the guy that showed up to the school in Spain, having gotten C's and D's all throughout high school Spanish. So it was a bit more challenging for me, but I got through it. I got up to a conversational level when I was in Barcelona. So now it's a matter of getting it back and learning some of the technical jargon, like if you're talking to a handyman, knowing the right word for the right tool or the right piece of equipment you're trying to get them to use. So, there's big gaps in my vocabulary, but again, it's an adventure trying to learn it and trying to use the combination of the words you know and then a bit of charades in order to get your message across.
Yeah, of course. And are you homeschooling your children or are they going to local schools in Costa Rica?
So there's an international school in the town we live in, and all three of them were in that school originally. And then we moved the oldest one out of it because the lower years was Montessori based and the teachers were really excellent. And then it's supposed to transition to an IB program in the upper years, but the middle years program isn't quite there yet. And he was coming home just saying he was bored. He wasn't doing anything interesting. So we said, okay, we can try something different and set them up homeschooling, set them up with online coursework. And then, of course, the whole COVID thing hit, and now everybody's homeschooled.
Yeah. So. I was just interested from the, if you're not FIRE, you're kind of certainly a version of FIRE already in doing your travel. So I was just interested in the investment that you're placing in the little ones for the second generation little guys who are going to be trying to get to a FIRE position, but hopefully a lot sooner than any of us did or will be able to.
I think one of the advantages of learning about this stuff is that you can have conversations with your kids about it. And, I was, 20 something before I understood what mutual funds were and things like that. Whereas my 10-year-old has a portfolio that's worth about $1,300 right now. The 7-year-old has $800 or $900 in his portfolio. For Christmas last year, they asked their grandparents, instead of some plastic toy made in China, can you buy me a VTI ETF, the Vanguard Total Stock Market ETF? And the grandparents were like, that's kind of a weird request, but if that's what you want, that's fine. So I think a couple different ways to answer your question, but having location-independent businesses, which we've got two of them set up and running now, allows us to live and work overseas sooner than if we had waited until we were FI to make it happen. It gives us like something to do as well. So it kind of keeps you, what I was saying earlier with the creativity, like the mental energy, it gives an outlet for that. And with the kids, I think it's good for them to see their parents working. And, we talk about business in front of them. We like each of them are starting their own businesses, even from a very young age. And then, we talk to them, okay, well, you made $20 this week. What are you going to do with that money? And, then it's, all right, well, I'm going to put this in the bank of dad. And then, okay, I can transfer that to your share account now. So you can buy a fractional share of this ETF or that ETF. And we use a company called Robinhood for the kids. Like we have their account set up there. And so they get the Robinhood snacks every week. And, they get to read about some of these companies and ask questions about what's going on in the stock market and stuff like that. So I think in 20 years, they'll have a pretty good head on their shoulders around finances, around business, around things like that, just because they're very much exposed to it. They're very much having conversations about that most days from a very early age. And it really does get you up the learning curve faster. You know, I've spoken to other entrepreneurs whose parents were entrepreneurs, and they're like, oh yeah, like I just grew up in this environment hearing these conversations. And so, you know, you just start out with a base level of knowledge that's higher than if you didn't have that growing up.
No, of course. I definitely did not have that growing up. I've always been a good saver. I just didn't know what to do with my money. So I just put it in a bank account because it seemed like a good idea at the time until I started to get into this properly.
Yeah. And yeah, and that's the thing. I don't know about UK schools, but I know the US schools that I attended, nobody ever taught me about money. You know, I think I had a home ec class in seventh grade or something like that. And they taught me how to sew. I had to learn how to make like one meal using the stove. And I think I had to set a budget or something like that. But that was the extent of it. And then it wasn't until, you know, my first job was with the bank, and I went through the Foundations in Financial Planning program. And it was just like my mind exploded. You know, it was like, wow, okay. And then you start learning about this stuff and you start to realize what the benefits of doing some of this stuff are. It's like, oh man, you know, if I had known when I was 14 years old, caddying, making $200 a week, that if I had just put $100 of that away each week, that it would be compounding over the next 50 years, would have been a significantly better situation.
I think one of my favorite things that I've seen coming out of the ChooseFI community is the people who are in those positions of education being able to go out and teach these concepts to the people whose lives they influence.
Yeah, definitely. That's actually one of the things I want to do next is when I'm done with the Simple Startup program for the kids, I want to do a course on money for that same homeschool group. Just, you know, explaining some of these concepts and working people through the numbers, because, you know, a lot of the math isn't that complicated. You can make it as complicated as you want, but a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old can do a lot of the math. And, you know, once you start to see how those numbers work, it can be very motivational. You know, as my 10-year-old likes to say, it's great to learn about this stuff when your costs are zero because, yeah, you know, I'm not paying for food, I'm not paying for rent, I'm not paying for clothes, so I can do whatever I want with my money. And yeah,
it sounds like you might want to start changing that if they're earning so much money on the side. We're curious. So, how long have you been in Costa Rica now?
About a year and a half now.
Okay, and you were like, was it 6 years in the UK as well?
Yep.
So you mentioned earlier on to me that I should probably look at, and what I was going to do anyways, is sell the house before I move over because of that primary domicile triggers a tax event for the IRS. Does that mean that you guys rent everywhere that you go? Are you forever renters, or do you settle down in each place that you move to?
This is the first time, so we've got some rental properties in the US. This is the first time in, I guess, our entire time being abroad that we actually bought a house as opposed to renting in the town we're in. And that was largely out of necessity. The rental market here tends to be short-term rentals. And so the prices are pretty outrageous. And it just made more sense to buy a place. And then what we can do actually, and what a lot of people here do, is you buy a place and then you can rent it out when you're gone. And obviously there's tax implications and all that kind of stuff. But if we want to go back to the States for Christmas each year, then we can rent the place out for those 2 weeks over Christmas. If we want to, you know, go visit family or travel over the summer, you know, that's like 8-10 weeks we can rent the house out each year. And it can cover a lot of the expenses that we would otherwise be incurring.
Okay, so you're using that short-term rental income to kind of balance out the fact that if you do move again in the future, you're going to have to pay the taxes on the house that you just sold.
Right. And so the other thing to think about is we have to have a gain for there to be a tax on the property. So, you know, we bought the house, say, like just to use easy numbers, say you buy a house for $100,000. If you sell it in 3 years' time for $100,000, there's no gain. So there's no tax. So, you know, if we have a big capital gain or something like that, then we'd have a tax on it. But the other way to think about it is you have a gain, right? So, you know, you have a tax, but you're also getting the gain on the property. And we've had the pleasure of living in it and everything like that over that period of time.
And so how does that work? If you were to sell your house in Costa Rica, would you be subject to Costa Rican and U.S.-based taxes because of it being in Costa Rica?
I don't know what the Costa Rican tax on it would be for the seller. They just implemented something, I believe, earlier this year. I haven't been thinking about selling, so I haven't gotten around to reading it. But I think it's like a 2% or 3% tax on the value of the property. So, you know, we would have that to contend with if and when we sell. And then, you know, we'd have the U.S. potential capital gain tax in the U.S. for it as well. But the other thing to think about is you want to be diversified, right? Diversification doesn't just mean in your stock portfolio. You can be diversified by having multiple passports. You can be diversified by having income streams and properties from different countries. And that could be a big benefit as well. You know, when we left the UK about 10 years ago, the pound, it was $2 to the pound. And right now it's like, what, $1.20, $1.25 to the pound?
Tell me about it. I feel so poor.
So there's an argument to be had that even country-wise, spreading your bets around a little bit makes sense as long as you're not paying too much money in the fees and the maintenance and all that kind of stuff to keep those accounts.
Yeah, that makes sense. And does that kind of fit in as to why you have the 1P account still open in England or...
Yeah, it was just one of those things that it wasn't at the top of the list when we were packing up and leaving. You know, I've been back to the UK a handful of times, and it's just like the hassle of going to the bank and waiting in the queue and going through the whole process. Like some of them are joint accounts. I'd have to do it with my wife. And yeah, you know, we now have three kids. You can imagine the joy of waiting in a bank queue with three kids just to close an account that has 1P in it. It's very low on our priority list these days. And I keep hoping that they'll just change the policy and say, because some of our other accounts, they have closed out on us. I used to work for Halifax Bank of Scotland, and I had an account with them, and they're like, sorry, you're a U.S. person. We're closing your account. Where should we send the check? So it's like, okay, well, that's one way to get the money out of it, but the other accounts, they haven't done that with yet.
Maybe they'll listen to this, and then they'll change the policy.
That would be a benefit for me and a huge, huge headache for a lot of other Americans living overseas. You know, one of the biggest complaints expats have is around the FATCA rules because it makes it really difficult for you to open local bank accounts and just live a normal financial life, make investments where you live, pay your electric bill, things like that. Example would be here in Costa Rica. I set up a local account here in Costa Rica, and because I'm a U.S. citizen, the most money I'm allowed to have in the account at any one time is $1,500. So, yeah, it's just you're paying more in wire transfer funds and dealing with stuff like that to set it up so you can pay your electric bill and your water bill and, you know, all this just normal things you have to do just because of being a U.S. citizen.
Have you heard of something called Revolut, Dave?
Revolut?
We can send you the details, but it's a card that me and Meg use that sets up accounts in different countries for you automatically and is easier to swap money because... At the moment, I figured that because of all the issues with tax in the future, the way that we run our investments at the moment with our savings rate, rather than me invest in terrible cash ISAs in the UK, I send money to Megan and we just pay spot rate through a couple of different applications that we use, but they're connected to each of my UK bank accounts. I have a US bank account that it opened up automatically for me. It does Poland and all sorts. So it might be something that would be really good for just getting around that FATCA rule, I guess.
It doesn't charge us any fees, right?
No fees, nothing.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear about that. And just what you're just saying, one of the interesting sort of like FI hacks that you guys might want to consider while you're in the US is, if you're not doing this already, setting up Roth IRAs. So it's after-tax money that goes in. So you don't really want to do this if you're in a very high tax bracket. But if you're not in too high a tax bracket, you can set up a Roth and you can each fund it $6,000. And then you can take that initial principal out anytime you need it. So what some people do is they set it up and they use that as their emergency fund. So like, obviously, you don't want to use your emergency fund. Hopefully, you don't have any emergencies. But you can put the money in there, and you can invest it in there. You can buy VTSAX or VTI or whatever it is you're looking to invest in. And then when you take the money out in the future, it'll be tax-free. So all the growth and everything is tax-free as well because it's a Roth IRA. But if you need it for an emergency in the short term, you can take the principal out. You can't put it back in, but you can take it out if you ever needed it.
So I have a Roth IRA, but is it possible for me to set up a spousal Roth for Matt if he's not a resident alien or a citizen?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because I feel like since he doesn't have an ITIN, we weren't even able to get a joint bank account over here without that.
Right. Now, I imagine you'd have to wait until you get your green card, but you know, a couple of years of investing in a Roth IRA could do a lot of good for you down the road.
No, absolutely. We do have an emergency stash, but there's no reason why that couldn't be our gift.
So we have a Roth IRA, and then I have my TSP, which is like the military's 401k, set up to where it was on Roth, but I've actually just switched it to now it's 45% going traditional and then another 5% going Roth, just because I was so close to maxing out to the next tax bracket. So in order to push myself down, I increased my traditional IRA limit.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
We've spoken about it a couple of times, and we think that because of the way the community really likes to use this Roth conversion ladder, we think that the numbers based on the fact that we're going to be getting income from these pensions means that actually we're probably choosing between paying one bracket of tax now or the exact same bracket of tax later. We don't think that it's necessarily going to work with us because we'll be receiving income on top of any other job that we have in the future. So we might as well just do Roth, the IRA at least, and then traditional to try and reduce the tax burden at the moment, just in case anything changes later down the line.
Well, in the future, you would be able to use your standard deduction to convert traditional to Roth tax-free. So it would depend on how much your pension income is and whether or not you keep your green card so it's taxed in the U.S. as well as, you said it would be tax-free in the U.K. So if it's just Meg's income, you'd have to look at how big the pension would be and what tax bracket you would fall into at that point. So let's say you're in a 10 or 15% tax bracket, you might still find it worth your while to convert from a traditional to a Roth if you're maintaining that 10 or 15% tax bracket, just because then the money will be tax-free forever. And it can grow for you. If you do decide to have kids at some point, you can use that as basically like a trust and give it to your child, pass, and then they can take money out of that tax-free for, I forget the exact details, but it's like 80 years or something like that. They can take money out tax-free as well. So, there's some pretty good reasons to try and get it into Roth. So when you're taking the money out of your, when you're getting paid out from your pension, just have a look at which tax brackets you're in, what rates you're hitting, and see if there's a little bit more leeway in that specific rate. And, obviously, if you can afford it, you can make some of those conversions as you go.
Okay.
Well, the U.S. Tax code is... was it four times larger than everything ever written by William Shakespeare?
Not surprising at all. And I, like you, I went to U.S. schools and we did not talk about this. I think I remember one day in high school where we did a 1040 easy, and that was about the extent of it.
Right. A couple other things to think about before you guys make the leap and you decide you're going to throw your backpacks on and travel the world. You can have a look. I guess, Meg, you'd probably be covered by health benefits if you're in the U.S. Do those cover you while you're overseas as well?
They should. As of right now, I'm active duty, so my military health care, anywhere that I go, if it's an emergency, is covered. Otherwise, if I were, say, on leave overseas and had something that was non-emergency, I would just have to call in and get authorization.
Okay, so that'd be pretty good.
I'm currently registered on Meg's healthcare through the U.S. Navy. I would normally have just sort of, for when we visit, travel insurance, but obviously with COVID going on, it's impossible to get travel insurance, so I'm relying on that. I don't know if that covers me if I decide to throw my green card off the side of a cliff and live in Costa Rica, but...
Yeah, a lot of places around the world have much less expensive healthcare than the United States. Even Costa Rica has very good healthcare, and it's a lot less than what you'd pay in the U.S. So, you know, that's one thing you're going to want to look at. If you can get like an international policy, a lot of international policies will cover you outside of the US and Canada. You know, for us, we're a family of five. We're paying, I want to say it's like $7,000 a year for, you know, very good coverage that covers us everywhere except for the United States. I've priced it out to get the same level of coverage in the United States, and it's over $20,000 a year. So you can work that into your FI budget as well, you know, the healthcare. Practically speaking, I've found it very helpful to have at least two different bank accounts the entire time we've been living overseas. A couple different reasons. Yeah, your ATM card is going to expire at some point. And if it happens to be at a time where you can't get the new one, you want to make sure you have a backup. Sometimes in some places, you might need to pay for 3 months rent all at one time. So you need to take out a larger amount of cash. Not all banks let you do that. So having a couple different bank accounts you can take money out of can help.
Are you still able to use US credit like, and apply for US credit cards?
Yeah. And you know, if you get your entrepreneur hat on, you could probably get yourself set up with the US credit card and use that to get all the points. So you put all your business spend on the credit card, you load up on points through business spend, and then you get the travel rewards on the personal side.
So yeah, I guess it was more of are you maintaining an address in the USA? I guess that's where your business is registered perhaps.
Yeah, we use a company called Mailbox Forwarding. And what they do is they can receive and scan our mail for us. And then we can say, okay, I've seen it. You can shred it or you can forward it over to me. You know, I can send it to my parents' address or something like that and pick it up when I'm home. And from experience, I can say that works significantly better than having all our mail go to either my parents or my wife's parents. And once a year you go and you got a stack of mail that's a foot and a half high that you're trying to open up and see what it all is. So, you know, if you're going to do something like that, it could make sense to use one of those services. Where do you live in the U.S.?
I live right outside of Fort Lauderdale at the moment.
Okay. So Florida is a good place to be resident of because there's no state income tax. So if you do go overseas, you're probably not going to have any state income tax liability. You know, I was from New York when I left 18 years ago. And yeah, New York, California, Virginia, a handful of other states are really, really sticky. They don't want people to not pay them tax. So it can be a real pain to get away from them or say you're not resident there anymore.
Absolutely. And I was from New Jersey when I joined the Navy. And okay. So my first year in the Navy, I got stationed in Florida. And then New Jersey tried to charge me. I think it was something very small, like $33 state tax or something. And so, of course, I was like, absolutely not. I'm not paying this. So I went and changed my residency to Florida. So luckily, as an active duty military person, you kind of have that benefit that once in your career, you can change to somewhere where you're stationed.
Right. And, you know, what other people have done and continue to do is South Dakota has a big RV community. So people can register that they live in South Dakota, they're resident of South Dakota. There's no state income tax, and you're only required to go there one day a year to maintain your residency. So I know a couple people who've done that. They switched their driver's license to South Dakota and all this kind of stuff. So you know, if you get transferred in the military back to New Jersey or Virginia, one of these California, like somewhere that has a high state income tax and you have to give up the Florida for some reason, that would be an option for you.
Yeah, that's good to know. It's crazy, actually. I think I've lived all over the country and I'll have a Florida driver's license with a Washington address. So you can imagine the questions I get if I get pulled over.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you were in the UK, did you make use of the tax-free help that we give to our workers over there? So were you using things like SIPs and whatnot?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Like when you're overseas, things can look like US vehicles and they're not. They're treated as foreign trusts, which is a whole different tax headache. So ISAs are technically viewed by the IRS as foreign trust accounts, and there's a whole host of different reporting you would have to do with those. Whereas SIPs are viewed as retirement vehicles. And so when I was in the UK, You know, I had a pension program at work, and when I left that job, I was able to roll that into a SIP, and so the money is just sitting in a SIP right now. So you want to think about that a little bit if you ever get another job overseas while you're maintaining your U.S. status. And I haven't looked into the details because I know, like with a SIP, you can take a 25% tax-free distribution when you retire and things like that. But I believe that in the U.S. that would be taxable at that time.
Right. Okay. I was just wondering if the... I mean, it would be silly to move somewhere and not make the most of the benefits in that country that you just moved to. But it sounds like you've made your investments and you're just kind of leaving it. Is it a rainy day fund or is it just a genuinely a retirement fund and you will open up those accounts once you reach the prerequisite? I think it's state pension age in the UK for SIPs. I'm 100%.
Yeah, it's 60 or 65, something like that. Yeah, it's I've got the money sitting in a Vanguard target date fund. When I get the notice from the company saying, all right, yeah, you got to start taking your required distributions, that's when I'll start taking required distributions. And till then, I just try to ignore it.
Yeah.
Except for my FBAR. I always put it on my FBAR, the FinCEN 114. Awesome. Let me, I'm just going to ping my email into the chat here. And if you guys have any other questions or after this, you think, oh, darn, we forgot to ask this one very specific thing. Yeah, feel free to ping me an email and we're happy to help out.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dave. Thanks for your time. It's been really, really informative, really helpful.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, awesome. Thanks, guys. And good luck on your FI journey and good luck the upcoming wedding and everything like that. Hopefully we'll hear more about you and your path to FI and eventually bump into you on one of the beaches here or something like that.
Awesome.
Hopefully. That's we look forward to it. Thanks so much.
I'll let you buy us a pina colada.
Margaritas. It's all margaritas.
Hey, everyone. Hope you got value from today's episode. I just wanted to say that, if you're listening to this Households of FI series, maybe this is the first episode of the Choose a FI podcast that you've ever listened to. And if you're saying, this is fascinating, I wonder what the overarching principles, like what's this journey that these individuals are on? This is the path to financial independence. And we talked about this in detail in episode 100. So I highly encourage you, if this is the first time you've even heard about the concept of financial independence, to go check that out for really a framework for this conversation that we're having, twice a week on Mondays and Fridays. Also consider going to choosefi.com/start to really access all the resources that we've put together to help you get on your own path to financial independence. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.